has in his music, in his work, affected just about all of us, and has worked in a musical scope that has really essentially affected American rock and roll for the last decade. And his name is Robert Hunter, and I guess everyone probably knows you best from the fact that you are quite often, in fact, most of the time, the lyricist for the Grateful Dead. And welcome.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here in Roslyn. I got up at 8:30 this morning and jogged across the bridge over to my father's place to look at it in daylight. And spent a couple of hours just walking up one side of the town and down the other. It's a beautiful place. I dig to come back here and spend a couple of weeks sometime.
I'm sure a lot of people would prefer you to be in the area more often than you are. You know what I'd like to do? And Robert and I were talking about this a bit before we started actually recording. I'd like to sort of chronologically trace your work, and we're going to have to speed through it simply because to do it properly and from the best historical viewpoint would take hours upon hours, because you have literally written thousands of songs, it seems like, and I'm sure there's many that we haven't yet had a chance to hear. To begin with, I guess, how did it start for you? Where did
songwriting? I started when I lived at in Stamford, Connecticut. It was had a band in the 12th grade called the Crescents, and went to Stamford High School for a year, and we would play around little dances and things. I played trumpet. I had a bass clarinet and a guitar and drums. We played veterans, hospitals, and weddings, bar mitzvahs, what have you. And I wrote a tune called Rock and Roll Moon, which I sent off to one of those little ads, Tin Pan Alley ads. It says, we will set, send us your tunes, you know, and we'll publish them for you or something like that. And I got a thing back that said that the words were good, but the music was lacking, and that they would rewrite the music for me for a fee and give me promotion and everything. And I was smart enough to know it was a scam right then. But that's how I started.
How did you cross paths with the Grateful Dead? And obviously had to be early in the history of the Dead.
Well, I came back to California, and I looked up an old girlfriend, so I had gone to 2 years of high school in California. Or I had been in school in California, 8th grade through 11th, I guess it was. And then I looked up an old girlfriend, and she was going with Garcia, so I met Garcia. And I had just gotten out of the Army, and I bought myself, I think it was a 1940 Chrysler Straight 8, really fine car. And so I had a car and nobody else had one. I ran into Garcia and Trist at St. Michael's Alley about a night later, and they found out I had a car, so they came banging on my door the next day wanting me to take them to Berkeley. And the three of us were pretty inseparable after that for a long time. And it was, I had been doing a folk singing at service clubs while I was in the Army. This is a 6-month hitch, it was all. And so I just fell into it naturally. I mean, I was at a party with Garcia, and there was one guitar there. So, you know, me being the folk singer, I didn't know he played, you know, I snatched it up and began singing my folk songs as I would do at parties. And he said, "Give me that guitar," right? So, you know, I was gracious, and I let him have it. He never gave the damn thing back the rest of the evening. So I got another guitar, and we got into duet playing, and we played at the local coffee houses and bookstore, and Kepler's bookstore, which was the place where the peace scene started happening. Roy Kepler and Ira Sandpearl, a bit number going out of there. So we were the house band, and we played at Stanford, whatnot, and then we took on Dave Nelson and started a bluegrass band, and went through several bluegrass bands, and then Mother McCree's jug band came up, and I was out of town for a while when that formed, And I came back and Jerry asked me if I wanted to play jug. And I gave a couple of poots into the jug and couldn't get a sound out of it and said, I don't think I can. So I didn't, I dropped out of the music at that point and went into another scene. And the Dead formed from that. And I went up to New Mexico for a while and wrote some lyrics. I think it was China Cat and Alligator and some stuff like that, and mailed them back to Garcia, and the band put them together. And so then I came back out and hooked up and just stayed with it.
Mm-hmm. What I'd like to do is to take the albums, perhaps, and we'll just sort of use them as a chronological kind of guide to your musical stuff and talk about some songs from each of the albums, perhaps, and get into playing as much as we can, because as I mentioned, we could go on for quite a while. We have a lot of material to work with, so why don't we do that? What's it like to be on, have your songs on so many records? I mean, I have a stack they can't see, but we have a real stack.
This is it, huh?
I'm even lacking a few here.
You have Red Octopus?
No,
and Dragonfly?
No, I don't have any of the stars.
Baron von Tobit. Yeah, I've been writing for them for a couple of years, too. Four albums right up to Spitfire was the first one in years I didn't have anything on.
Well, we will,
it's for about 5-10 pounds. Never seen them all together.
All right, we'll work on them. Now, the first album that you are credited for actually writing on is Oxymoxa.
Yeah, for some reason they didn't give me credit on Alligator for Anthem of the Sun. I was quite disappointed.
Yes.
Dark Star on it, too. No, it only has Alligator. That's all I wrote on that.
So Alligator really was the first recorded Hunter composition. What was it like when you heard that? Do you remember what your reaction was to hearing your words put to the music of the Dead?
Well, by the time it was out on the record and like that, I'd heard it considerable number of times. It was quite exciting, actually, though, when I came from New Mexico to hear them playing Alligator. It was because I'd been sitting around playing it for friends, and it was. Well, you know, they weren't like the Grateful Dead at that point. It was exciting, but it wasn't exciting enough to blow your mind exactly. It was small time at that point. I think we sold about 25,000 copies of Oxymoxa and probably less of that than Anthem. But still, it was the business. And I went out there. We were doing a gig in Rio Nido, and that afternoon before the performance, first and where I heard them playing my stuff, they were working on Dark Star. So I was just in the motel room hearing the music from across the way. And I scratched the lyrics out for that, about half of it then, and went in and presented them with that, and that worked right away. So, you know, we all knew each other well enough that it was really easy to function. They assumed that I was the writer right away, and I assumed that I was too, and just picked up from there.
All right. To move on to, Oxymoxa really presented a song that has been a big favorite, and of course, probably because it was on the Live Dead album, and got an awful lot of airplay and reaction on that, and that was St. Stephen. What do you recall about that particular song?
Well, I had a silly little melody for it, and let's see. I think I wrote that about one time. It's not easy to recall. I think I wrote it in three or four sittings. I liked, I got into a lyric flow with it, a sense of some sort of importance about it. I had some nice experiences of writing just the right thing, you know, of that sort of unbelief of it, seeing the words just coming out so nice. And, but it was, that was the Dead then again, you know, like realizing at that point that I was writing it for them gave me a kind of an energy that I used at that point. It was exciting when I realized that I was going to write an album I'd been invited to.
Robert Hunter is our guest. Robert, a performer in his own right. and a lyricist for many, many songs that you know from the Grateful Dead. And as you pointed out, the Jefferson Starship. And we were going, tracing essentially back in the early stages of the Grateful Dead. Live Dead, certainly a very important album in their evolution. What were those tunes like doing?
Well, I told you about Dark Star and St. Stephen. The 11 was originally part of China Cat. And, but that got clipped and put into a different segment. I think they used to do China Cat and the 11 together a lot, actually. And the others, that's all I really have to say about that one. I think the lyrics were published on this one, which was the first time that I did that, and last time I did that until Blues for Allah. Although I'm telling you, I wrote, I guess, all but one of the lyrics on Garcia's new album, and I'm going to publish lyrics again because I'm beginning to find out after all these years that they aren't really heard too well, and I don't like that, so I'm going to do it.
Have you ever considered publishing the lyrics in any kind of book form? Is that a possibility?
There's a stack of them here that I'm... just about all of them that I'm working on editing right now, because there were a lot of errors in it. To make sure that they didn't publish the lyrics, which I didn't want for a while, I felt that if someone could read the lyrics and listen to the music, they only had to go through the album once, and I wanted them to dig more than that. I know that I had a tendency to do that when the words were written down, and I wanted them to take the whole thing as a unit. So, I don't really have fair copies of many of the lyrics at all. I would make the secretaries take the tapes and transcribe them from the tapes, and there are errors in all the transcriptions. There are errors in the lyrics and the songbooks even because of that. But I felt that if I wrote them all out that they were going to get published, so I just wanted to have kinds of copies around. And now I'm working through it and neatening it up towards publishing them.
Great. Working Man's Dead next.
That's my baby. I like that record.
That was essentially the commercial breakthrough, wasn't it, Working Man's Dead, as far as the band went?
We were in New York, and I remember getting into an elevator. Like, we had gotten around 190 on the charts, something like that before. We were getting in an elevator, and somebody, I think it was Rock, came up and said, "We're number 17 in Billboard with a bullet." Block. You know, and that was the beginning, you know, like all of a sudden, I mean, that elevator was going up. Right? We might have been going down in it, but yeah, it was an amazing flash, you know, just one of those fill your head with light trips. You say, my God, we're really making it, you know, it's not a fantasy anymore.
To talk about Working Man's Dead, one of the prettiest songs that you have ever written is Uncle John's Band.
Yeah, that's honey. That's also one of the few tunes on this record that I worked very, very hard at. Jerry made a tape of the tune, and I sat with that tape. We were living in the same house at the time, which is one reason that the collaboration through this and American Beauty is so good, because we were just right there all the time for a couple of years. But, I don't know, Uncle John's Band, yeah. I had that feeling that that this was a tune. You know, this is worth really working, really getting correct. What else is it? High Time and Dire Wolf. Dire Wolf I wrote waking up one morning after having had the dream that the story is describing. And kind of before I fully woke up, I sat down and just grabbed the guitar and put the thing right down. And Speedway Boogie I wrote right after Altamont, I think the next day, because the press was coming in and it was just terrible. And so this was like a press release for immediate release, you know, about the only thing we could say about it, you know, one way or another, whether we could just keep on coming or stand and wait. You know, there was no alternative but to keep doing what we were doing, even though at that point it boiled into a tragedy, I suppose, in some people's eyes. Well, it was, certainly. Cumberland Blues, I don't remember writing that. That's, I draw a blank on when that might have been done.
The song that you you get a phone call for every show you do at WLIR is Casey Jones. I mean, it is just one of the most popular tunes around.
At one point, I just, in my notebooks on one page, I had just written, I don't know what prompted it, I heard the line in my head, and it just tickled me. Driving that train, high on cocaine, Casey Jones, you better watch your speed. And that was the only thing written on that page, and it was probably about 3 or 4 months later when I opened the book up and just continued it. I mean, it was easy to continue. It was an easy song to write. Popped right out. It's classic in a way, you know, the story of Casey Jones. I just put the additional twist of one reason that he may have been driving too fast, trying to make things on time. Well, there's Working Man's Dead done.
All right.
Except for High Time, which I don't remember much about writing either.
Robert Hunter is our guest. We're WLIR-FM at 92.7 in stereo. I'm Dennis McNamara, and we're going through the works of Robert Hunter, which is quite a lot of music, quite a lot of great music. Working Man's Dead, where we just finished off, and American Beauty. We were very close, I thought. You mentioned that earlier, but certainly there was a feel that came out pretty quick together.
There is a third album in that, what I consider a series of Working Man's Dead, American Beauty, and then this Grateful Dead album, the live one.
Europe.
It's, yeah, Europe 72. Let me open this thing up and see what the
shrink wrap pulled away.
And I've asked Warner Brothers, because they're into putting out Best of the Grateful Dead albums and things, and they're doing a pretty nice job on that. But this I would like put out as one record, which is a companion, I feel, to those others. This is a surprise to me when this came out into a three-album set, because there was an album of songs, which was a companion to those, which had He's Gone, Jack Straw, Brown-Eyed Women, Ramble on Rose, Sugar Magnolia, no wait, not Sugar Magnolia, it's from Oxmox, Mr. Charlie, Tennessee Jed. And this is a fine, fat album of songs, right, which is, people don't maybe dig, like, through listening to all three albums that are here in this set. So I would like Warner Bros. To release that one as a companion to those other, because I feel that in those three albums I hit kind of the peak of my songwriting. Mm-hmm. But I hope I'll get another peak. But, boy, I look back at some of the stuff I wrote and I go, whoopee, boy. I guess I just have to have my head back in that space, you know. You do this thing for a decade and more, and some of the thrill definitely is gone, seeing, oh, ho-hum, here's another record, but I have credits on like that. But, boy, that first credit, you know, that not getting it on Anthem, that still smarts. You know, I remember how it felt not to have it on there. But now it's getting... Yes, I think that this, I'm hoping that this going out with my band, and especially like starting to do my own solo show, is going to give me the feeling again. I haven't been out on the road for years now, and today, just getting up, doing what I used to do on the road, you know, getting out and trucking, you know, jogging across the bridge, you know, looking in windows, you know, forgot to shave, looking scruffy, and all of a sudden I thought, wait, this is Nassau County. You could get busted for looking scruffy here, can't you?
No, times have changed.
Yeah?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. Well, anyway, I was walking along feeling just the way I always felt, you know, like kind of like a nice, healthy, happy underdog. Mm-hmm. And I some of that feeling was back, you know, like up in Buffalo, I remember, up in the winter, just getting out there. The thing I do, I get up first thing every morning because I was seeing the country, the band snoozing away all day. And I was a crackerjack for getting up and seeing the towns.
All right.
Today, I hope something comes of it.
Great, that's good to hear. American Beauty is the album that we're at now. And again, boy, we could just pull off just about any song. And you'll find a favorite.
Yeah. I've been sitting here before you came in running over Box of Rain. I'd like to perform that. That'd be a very good solo song, just a guitar and a voice. Do that quite well. Friend of the Devil, I do with Comfort. I do Friend of the Devil, and once in a blue moon I do Ripple with him. Mm-hmm. But as I said, I'm very, very tentative about doing Grateful Dead songs with Comfort. And when we do them try and do them kind of different, as different as you can get them, having them be the same song. I do a real up-tempo Friend of the Devil.
Well, I was going to ask you, Sugar Magnolia, that's one that is quite popular. What was that like? What do you think back to when you think about that?
That's a song that went through a lot of transitions before. And things started with some kind of, I had a melody for it.
Blossoms bare. I haven't got a thought about it, that's all I care. Sugar looking motor manicure, my line. Well, wrote a note to tell you everybody is fine. The sugar magnolia, you can't better beware. You can't go casting notions with a hook in the air.
And I passed that on to Weir, and it turned into the monster that it is. He just worked to death on it, and Weir's a hard taskmaster. He wants everything to be just the way he wants it, so we went around and around and around about it. Then he'd go off and work on it some more, and then he'd bring it back and demand more lyrics or better lyrics, and then when it was all done, he wanted some extravaganza to cap it all off, so I wrote that Sunshine Daydream thing for, like, right in the studio. I just went out in the other room, wrote it down, handed it to him, said, that's just fine, and then just tacked it on. That's how that happened. I do think that's a monster. The first time that song ever came off in concert was in Chicago. They had been playing it a lot, but the audience had only reacted very mildly to it. So Bob Matthews was at the soundboard at that time, and he went off into the audience or backstage or something like that, and there was nobody there at the sound booth. So I zipped in there, and we started singing, and I just cranked his vocal up, which is like, because there's a kind of a thing where everything should be at the same level, including the voices, which tended to get lost. And I just cranked it up, and the audience just sat up to the thing, and then they had the reaction to it at the end that they've had ever since, like that. So from that point up, that vocal got turned up, and it worked. And then the audience came running back, smacked my hands.
Truckin' is a song that, I guess, you know, if you walked up to the average Grateful Dead fan and said, name three songs, Truckin' would be in there probably. It's really the story of what it was like, I guess, right?
I wrote that verse to verse pretty much on the road. And, look, I wrote the verses, a few lines about Texas I wrote down in Dallas. And I wrote the verses about Buffalo up in Buffalo. You know, it was, and it was intended to be a continuing chronology. In fact, the boys asked me a couple of months ago if I would update it. I said, oh, no, I let sleeping dogs lie, but they insisted, and so I did. And I don't know if they're going to do new verses or not. Hard to say, but I wrote about half a dozen more, and they were very easy to write. It's a groove that I can fall into so easily. It reminds me that I wrote that song when I sit down and write more to it, because I can get right into the same flow on it.
Robert Hunter is our guest. Robert is... I don't know. I find it so hard to go around and explain it. You are, whether it says it or not on the albums, you are very definitely an important member of the Grateful Dead, and have been for a long time.
Well, they used to list me as part of it, see? On the band, Robert Hunter, songwriter, like that. They stopped doing that when they started using, on this album, I don't think on the Grateful Dead album here that I'm listed as songwriter anymore. Because they did things like Me and My Uncle, Big Boss Man, Me and Bobby McGee and Johnny B. Goode. I didn't write any of that stuff, so I kind of got... And I didn't really insist too much. I tended to not follow my own interests very much. And they stopped listing me as songwriter, and in the public's eye, when it isn't written, when it isn't in print, then it isn't that way anymore. And, you know, audiences are fickle. They have a memory span of about 2 years. And so if you don't keep pumping yourself, you can disappear in this business very, very quickly, which I woke up a year or two ago and realized it happened to me, that I had just dropped into the obscurity that could have been predicted from not doing any promo or interviews and whatnot. I'm beginning to realize that it's not good policy to make enemies of the press, and the way that you make enemies with the press is not doing interviews. And the appearance is that you're too good for that. And maybe I did have some such tomfool notion at the time that I didn't have to get my own feet wet.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a nice trip there writing for the dead, keeping my privacy, being unrecognized, and still having it all coming in. It was a very, very nice space. And now I'm paying for it. I think I'm paying some belated dues. We're working real hard at this band. And when we aren't working, we're not rehearsing the band or on the roof, and I'm working on my solo show, it keeps me busy, and I'm really enjoying it. I love performing. I get a lot of energy, and I'm pretty much jumping jack flash on the stage. I warm up quick, and I love it.
Is that you, Eddie? Maybe you give me some reflections on them, and
sure.
You throw songs back at me and reflect, if that makes sense. A song that's been recorded in a number of varieties, and all of them pleasing, is playing in the band. Real, real good tune. Can you tell me about that? And which version I should play after we talk about it?
Oh, Lord, I don't remember the various versions of it. I don't have a needle on my stereo set, and I haven't played any of these records in years, just years and years and years. I don't really have to, because I remember them in my head and just put the needle on and hear most of them.
Great version of it on the Bob Weir Ace album.
Nicky had a rhythm for it, and I wrote the words to Nicky's rhythm. And then Weir came in, dug it, and Nicky asked him to put the chords to it. Yeah, which he did, and that's about all there was to that song on Mickey's album, Here Which Falls. It says music by Weir and Mickey, and words by me. It was another interesting one. Mickey took his tape recorder out to his pump room, and the pump goes, and Mickey's crazy enough, he does this. He comes to me, he hands me this tape of his pump, and says, write words to it. So I was listening, so I actually went down to the pump room finally, and just took my pad and paper and wrote it to the pump. Moses came riding up on a guitar, and then, and well, Weir came around again like that, and he set the da 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 and put some chords to it, and then we had another song provided for us by nature in a way. That's the story of that. It's called The Greatest Story Ever Told Now on Weir's album.
What about Bertha? Is it true she was a fan? An electrical fan?
No, this was after the fact. I don't know where that story. They started calling this fan in the office that would run around and try and catch everyone and cut their fingers off. They started calling it Bertha, but no, this is not true. And Bertha, I think, is probably some vague connotation of birth, death, and reincarnation, and the cycle of existences. That's some kind of such nonsense like that. I wouldn't be surprised, but then again, it might not be. I don't remember.
Birth is another one that is very, very popular, one of the most popular Grateful Dead tunes.
Oh, yeah, it's such a good... It's going to usually be a good night when they start off playing Bertha.
What about working with Jerry Garcia as a solo performer for his solo albums? Does that affect you in your writing or anything when you write a song? I guess I should ask, do you know if it's going to be for a Grateful Dead album or for a Garcia or Bob Weir solo album?
Sometimes. The best that can happen is that I'm just being prolific at the time and just have lots of songs and then pass them around. But that happens most of the time as I initiate them and I give Jerry lyrics. He'll work on them, and then less often he'll give me tapes of tunes or play them for me, and I'll tape them and I'll write them on the spot.
Let's go to the first Garcia solo album.
Back here.
We have albums all over the floor here.
This is the next one. Were it not a Garcia solo album, would fit in right with that Working Man's Dead, American Beauty, and Europe 72 feel of songs. This would be even four together, but this is not fair to add that to it since this is a solo album. But this has got a lot of the things that have that same sort of feeling that the American Beauty songs have, the Sugary and Loser, especially, and Deal. Yeah, that bird song we wrote for Janis Joplin, which is not commonly known.
Sugar Ray, what was that one like?
I remember when I was being a criminal back many years ago. A friend of mine always used to say, when he'd leave, he'd say, "Okay, hold your mud and don't mention my name." And that was the genesis of Just Don't Tell 'Em You Know Me. It was kind of that criminal consciousness, the ethic that when you get busted, when they come to take you down, hold your mud and don't mention my name. That's the essence of it.
And the deal? Can you talk about that a little?
So that's how it goes. It costs a lot to lose.
That's it. That's probably less reflections on what it's like being in the rock and roll business or the music business. It costs a lot to win, but it costs even more to lose. And all I'm asking you for is one gold dollar that I can pay you back with one good hand. That's the situation I'm in with Comfort right now. All I'm asking for is support, because I got this number going, and if I can get support on it, which I think I can, I hope I can, then I can do it, you know, and I can give people more music. And if it isn't supported, then it's going to go down the tubes, and I'll get back to my typewriter, I suppose. We'll see. This is an important time for us coming out to New York. And it's a large band, it's 8 pieces. It's not that easy to... we won't make any money on the trip. We'll lose some on it. And but we want to get heard out here, and I want a chance to play for these people. I've been told that I'll have a really good reception here without fail, and I'm just looking forward to it. Let's see.
I would say whoever told you that is absolutely correct, because this is the right market. Getting into marketing business type terms is the deal would have you, I guess.
The wheel also expresses that sort of sentiment. The wheel is turning and you can't slow down and you can't get... The wheel is turning and you can't hold on, you can't let go and you can't slow down or something like that. That's also the nature of this business. You know, you are on that... You're riding the back of the tiger and you get off and obscurity waits right there for you. Once you get a taste for this, you don't want to get obscure, I gotta say. Because you know, I've been talking to people for a long time. And, boy, you know, I really want to keep doing that. I'd love to do it. It's, you know, if I can find something to say, or stay alive, basically, stay aware and alive, I think I have something to say.
All right, Robert Hunter is our guest. We're WLIR-FM at 92.7 in stereo. Picture a hotel room, I guess in Rosman is where we are, and a whole lot of albums all over the floor because we're sort of jumping around. And Robert has written songs for the Grateful Dead for most of their career, from the beginning. Most of the songs that people know he's written for the Starship. We haven't talked about the Starship at all. What was that? Was that anything different, essentially, than working with the Grateful Dead?
The Starship, I worked with Freiberg, and he was an old friend from Quicksilver days, when he played bass for Quicksilver, and he just came around. He had been wanting to write with me for years, but he'd never really had a vehicle to do it with, and he fell in with... Paul and Grace after the airplane broke up, and he came around. I think it was Baron von Tolbooth was the one that we wrote Harp Tree on, which is another one. I wish I could find the changes for it. I don't, as I said, I don't have a needle for my record player. I don't have a copy of the words, and I don't have a lead sheet anywhere. I'd love to learn the song, but I just can't remember too much how it goes except for the lyrics. And then after that, he came over with Grace Slick's solo album. A very strange thing happened on that. For some reason...
Is that the Manhole album?
Yeah. She was gracious enough. Totally surprised me when the album came out. I thought I was writing it for her. And on her solo album, there's a song by me and Freiberg, sung by David. I don't even think she plays anything on it. And I can't explain it. It's called It's Only Music. It's a nice tune. Then I wrote Come to Life with Freiberg for the Dragonfly album. And then I wrote Tumblin' on Red Octopus with Freiberg.
Which Marty Balin sang, didn't he?
And then Marty wrote the lyrics, go, this time I'll ever go, this time. Marty wrote that, but he put the schmaltz in it like that. And I really respect that guy. He's for his love of Schmaltz, you know, because he does, and he'd be the last to deny it. He likes that crooner edge on it, because he is one of the all-time great crooners, I think. One of the last of the crooners, too. I guess I blew it. I wrote one for what turned out to be the Spitfire album. I wrote a tune called Nighthawk, and it was going to be the title piece for the album, and they had the cover drawn and whatnot, and I was just waiting for it to come out, and I ran down to my record store. There it was, and the song wasn't on it, much less was it not the title tune. I realized that, I just didn't put the attention to them that I do with the Dead. I didn't, hang out or try and be part of the band very much. And the guys who were writing the band, I think it was replaced by something that the drummer wrote. And the people in the band who are working and functioning in the band should have the publishing and the tunes on it. So I never felt in the least bitter about not doing that, and subsequently I haven't worked with them. But not that I wouldn't. In a flash, they asked me, but they're off on another trip now. But I was with them while in that between the airplane and Starship thing. It was a nice time, and I enjoyed being part of them. While they were underdogs, it was fun. They're not underdogs anymore, but they were for a while. And it is fun working with underdogs.
Okay, Robert Hunter.
I also would like to say that I think Grace Slick is one of the best lyricists around. No, I don't think that she gets cited for that very often. Boy, she writes a mean, rangy lyric. You know? She does.
As a lyricist, who else do you respect? I mean, what lyrics from contemporary music around today do you look at and say, wow, that's well done?
Robert Burns and Walter Scott. Contemporary, I'm just not. I'm very, very, what's the word, bemused, somewhat amazed. Patti Smith's lyrics are quite a trip. They're very, very heartfelt. She's, and very unusual. She has a tendency to, grand notions, which I think is fine. Like, she really, she's. There's no little things sitting there. There's this big, full of jewels and blood and things. Maybe even to a fault in certain respects. I think she may temper that. After a while, it can lose its effect with too much of the heaviness. But too many people don't have any at all. And she has an amazing amount. Very, very good. And I hope she keeps recording. Springsteen, I thought, was quite good. Like that, he's got a way with a tough lyric. I think those lyrics for Born to Run are just phenomenal. It's like, day we sweated out on the street of a runaway American dream. At night we ride to visions of glory in our suicide machines. Chill out my back. Springsteen is quite good.
Robert Hunter is our guest. And Robert is a lyricist for the Grateful Dead. He's worked with the Starship and has released a couple albums of his own. We've talked about the Dead up to a certain point, and then we sort of were led astray talking about other things, and solo projects, of course, were in there. At that point, Bob Weir had a solo album. Jerry has released three or four solo albums. At this point, there's a new one coming as we speak. And Mickey Hart had one.
It's his hottest product right now.
Yeah. The Bob Weir album or the Garcia? The Weir album is out, man. It is hot. Bombs away.
The PDQ. It's done and ready to be out. That has the best writing I've done in a Coon's Age on it, I gotta say. Got some excellent material on that. It was really a blast making it. We got our own studio at last, and we just hung out there for months and months and months doing that.
This is a little weird, but as we speak, the new Cherry Garcia album isn't out, but maybe let's talk about some of the songs, and hopefully by part two of the show, the album will be out. We'll take that chance.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the title song. It's Cats Under the Stars, which is a tune that I had been working on for years, and I started working on it in London, I think. It's just a pleasure to have it finally done and out, and as boss as it is, it's kind of a subterranean march of cats. The best I can say was bum 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 by Orpheus. It's called Ruben and Cherise, which is one that I wrote for his several years ago for his second album, Reflections, but it just didn't get around to getting done until now. And it's an Orphaic epic set in New Orleans, rather after the manner of Black Orpheus, in that it's taking the Orpheus story and setting it in a carnival atmosphere. I set it in New Orleans, and it has a Reuben, who is Orpheus, has a painted mandolin and laid with a pretty face in jade. After the betrayal of Eurydice, who is Cherise, with Ruby Claire, the death scene occurs when Reuben is strumming his painted mandolin to Ruby Claire when she freezes and turns to stone, for the strings played all alone. The voice of Cherise from the face of the mandolin singing, "Reuben, Reuben, tell me true, for I have no one but you." He's saying, it's all cool, but you know, there is no one but you. If you could see in my heart, you'd know it's true. There's none, Cherise, except for you. At the beginning of it, Cherise was dressing as pure red and white when a fatal vision crossed her sight, said to Cherise, "Beware tonight." And said, she has a vision of what's going to go wrong. And at the end of it, when he brings Eurydice back from the hell, it was Reuben walk. It has one of the repeating themes, and it was her hair hung gently down. The last theme was Reuben walk the streets of New Orleans till dawn with Cherise so lightly in his arms and her hair hung gently down. And when Garcia sings this thing, it just brings goosebumps up my arm. It shivers up my spine. The full tragedy. I think we got it. We got Orpheus, which is, you know, every artist is supposed to do an Orpheus, I feel. And that was ours.
When we last left the Grateful Dead, they had left Warner Brothers Records and had gone out to record on their very own record label, which unfortunately was a great idea but short-lived and didn't work out, I guess, on the economic side.
Well, I'll tell you, I didn't give them the material. Here we were all set up, ready to go, ready to rip. And if I had written albums like I'd been writing, fine. But, you know, it's just one of those situations where you get this nice, snazzy Cadillac and everything, and the battery doesn't work for some reason. It's, my streak ended. I don't know what it was. It's the feeling, Wake of the Flood, I think, has some excellent songs on them. They don't grab, or didn't grab the public the way the other ones did. They're exceedingly laid back, for one thing. What is on that album? I think some of the problem was with the Reuben's choice of tempos on tunes like Row Jimmy Row is a good example of a tune which works very, very well at that tempo on stage, because with all the power they can just get the place, you know, rocking slowly back and forth. But I don't really think it translates to the album at that tempo. A bit quicker would have moved it. Stella Blue's one of my favorite. I love that, and I'm not certain that it's the best rendition that we've ever done of it on this album. And Mississippi Half Step Uptown Toodaloo is also, I think, one that suffers for tempo. Not to us, you know, or to dyed-in-the-wool fans or anything like that, but the public at large wants things a bit snappier. Mm-hmm. And Eyes of the World stands on it. That was fairly successful, I think. Sounds about the way it should.
With the appearance of the Grateful Dead's own record label, shortly after Wake of the Flood came the release of the first Robert Hunter album.
Yeah. Well, I had been working with Roadhog, some of my early bands, and I went over to Mickey's and said, "Could I have a couple of days in the studio? I'd like to lay down an album real quick." And about 4 or 5 months later, I emerged with this monstrosity, and in which time I had to throw away a lot of the early tracks I made with Roadhog, because they just weren't solid, and I had Freiberg came in and worked a lot on that album, and Barry Martin helped me out a lot, and Mickey drummed on it. And,
the album is Tales of the Great Rum Runners. Great cover. Beautiful.
Yeah, Rick Griffin. Yeah, this and Tiger Rose are two of the best covers that we have amongst all of these, I think. But, I love the songs on them, on this record. My singing on it is, a little short of pathetic. Well, I hadn't sung in about 10 years, in front of people. And, I just, I hear it's a lyricist album. There's some of them that come off pretty well. I like Rum Runners. It's got Must Have Been the Roses on it, which remains just about the favorite thing I've written. I do that with, comfort, too. Yeah, this has got some fine tunes on it. It's a pity that it's so rough and ready. Although a lot of people like that quality about it. It's got, certainly doesn't have any pretension on it because we weren't capable of pretension at that point.
Moving onward, Robert Hunter is with us, and we're talking about his music and the Grateful Dead music and a whole lot of music that he has been involved in. Blues for Allah was released, and boy, side one sure opened up with a killer. That medley of Help on the Way, Slipknot, and Franklin's Tower was just, I don't know, one of the best things I think the Grateful Dead have ever done. My own personal opinion. It seems to be quite popular.
I don't know.
What a surprise.
Oh, I've just heard so many bad reports and so few good things ever about this album. The people didn't take to it. And, I was living in England with, while they were laying down tracks, or this was the first time I had ever worked this way, where they put down all the tracks, and so I came in with pretty complete basics to work with, and wrote the lyrics to an album that was already there, and I'm not certain that I do my best work that way. I don't know.
Do you have a favorite there? Any album? Any
Crazy Fingers? Crazy Fingers is a set of about 7 or 8 haiku. Each of the verses is a haiku, and I'm rather proud of that.
Did the medley that opens up side one, was that all instrumentally combined when you were listening to it, and did you write 3 separate songs? Is that how that happened?
Franklin's Tower, I had given Jerry 6 months before. That's the only one on this that he set music to my words. The rest of them were just given to me. And I worked very, very hard on this album. I wrote most of these songs on the order 20, 30 times, trying to get them just right. And I believe that my lyrics are overworked on this. It was not just that tendency. You start being a professional artist, and you take a great deal of pride in what you do, and you sort of start slipping away from your inspiration in a way, and you start bearing down too hard on it, trying to perfect each line, trying to make each one a jewel, and I'm not for working that way anymore, because I don't think it's what it is that I can do with a lyric doesn't really come out at its best that way, because I can make something overworked, I can tool until it's a glittering jewel that nobody can see but me, and if nobody likes it, then I don't like it either. Because they are supposed to communicate. They are supposed to be meaningful.
Blues for Allah. And following Blues for Allah, wait a second. We've missed Mars Hotel. It's mixed in here probably somewhere else. We probably passed it earlier on. We must talk about U.S. Blues. Because that is another one that is a crowd pleaser.
That started out as a... The song that we did, One More Saturday Night, was originally U.S. Blues, but he got it into his mind to rewrite the lyrics, and then he still wanted to call it U.S. Blues, and I said, no way, I'll write another U.S. Blues, you know, which I did, and that's all I remember of it. I don't remember where I wrote it or what. I probably wrote in England. I was doing a lot of my writing in London at that point. First writing I did in London, first time I went over there, was I had this feeling of I'd never had here in an American writer. And it just put me in a real good perspective about that. And I wrote, I sat down one afternoon with a bottle of Retsina, a case of Retsina. No, it was a case. I didn't drink the whole case, but I had all that I wanted. Just bathing and being in England for the first time. You know, a lot of people dreaming about going to London, and I was one of them, and it was so nice being there. I just sat down, I think, in an hour period. I wrote Ripple Broke Down Palace and To Lay Me Down, and I could have written more. I could have just kept doing it, and I just said, well, that's certainly enough for the day, you know, and quit. I kind of wish I'd kept on that day, though. That was one of the best streaks I'd ever had. And when you're hot, you're hot.
A song you have referred to, and one that you seem happy about, is Scarlet Begonias.
Love it. I've just been learning how to perform it with a solo guitar, and it's a lot of fun. It's really a pleasure. It was originally pages and pages long. There was a very, very involved story there. It was like quite a plot, and I finally got honed down to just the basic moves in it, which is best. Although there is, it's originally called Bristol Girls, and there's one line in it that I'm using. I am adding and changing lines or using old verses that the Dead don't use in some of these songs. Friend of the Devil is another one. And then this is, look all around this whole wide world, never find nothing stranger than a Bristol girl. And so get some of that hit back in terms. In Friend of the Devil, when I perform it, I have a verse that I originally did write when I wrote it with Dave Nelson. And Dave Nelson and Marmaduke and I sat down. I was playing bass for the New Riders for a while, and we sat down and to write a song, and I came up with that Friend of the Devil. And one of the original verses, which I now use, is the last verse. Now, you can borrow from the devil, you can borrow from a friend. The devil give you 20 when your friend got only 10. That gives me a little feeling of a more overt ownership of the song. Because you know, these have been dead property, these songs, so long that I almost feel that I shouldn't touch them even. But I talked to Jerry about it a couple weeks ago. He said, hell, he said, do any of them you want. He said, you know, like, because we've been playing together, Mutual Group, or whatever you call it. So I've been opening for him. And it got down to, I said, you know, I don't do It Must Have Been the Roses when I'm performing with you, although it's, you know, the strongest song in my repertoire, probably. And he said, go ahead and do it, any of them at the same time. And we even decided that maybe we would do similar sets some night. He'd do the same material my band did, like that. And there's no reason not to do them twice, three times, because they're all different in our interpretations of them. It Must Have Been the Roses, I had thought of as my signature tune, and old Jer decided he wanted to do it, and I was not too happy about it, because I had recorded it already, because I knew what a monster he is, that song would no longer be identified with me once he did it, so I almost think it was a dead tune that I do now. But it got out there. And then he wanted to do Tiger Rose, and I said, well, come on, don't do that. You know, I finally said, okay, do Must Have Been the Roses. I'm not going to be a dog in a manger about the whole thing. I didn't sell it. Maybe you can. And but Tiger Rose is one of my other signature to him like this. I got to keep one of them. So he's agreed. He won't touch Tiger Rose anyway.
All right, our guest is Robert Hunter. I'm Dennis McNamara. We're LIRFM. Boy, we have... been tracing through a whole lot of music. To get back to the Grateful Dead, there was the Steal Your Face album, another live collection.
What was it that Lester Bangs and Cream Magazine wrote about? Steal Your Face, ha, Steal Your Money is more like it. This is not our most popular album. I don't think I have anything original on it either. Oh, this is one that Must Have Been the Roses by the Dead. Not a good version. Mm-hmm. They have done that so beautifully. Also, Stella Blue, they have done so beautifully. And neither, again, both of these songs don't come up. We have not got a definitive Stella Blue recorded.
There are so many Grateful Dead tapes around, you would think that you'd be able to pull them off. Right, yeah, but it's just not the same as doing it when you want it, I guess, for record. To move past Steal Your Face, you released a second solo album.
God, had the audacity.
And as you mentioned, Tiger Rose, a song that you feel an identity song, I guess, essentially, to paraphrase you as you sit here.
The title of my album, you know. So it it's a recognition tune. People don't even have to have heard it. They've at least seen the album cover, so when I sing Tiger Rose, they applaud a little bit. They know it or not.
What was it like going in to do an album the second time around?
This album was under the auspices of Round Records. This time, I knew that my album would be released. With Runrunners, I didn't know that, and I don't think I really could have sold that album if I didn't have my own record coming, because it doesn't meet professional standards for recordings. It's quite dirty in some respects. But Tiger Rose was produced by Garcia. He got in there, he figured that he was going to... He mixed Runrunners for me, and he said it was just a real monster. I had made such a mess of my tracks that... He got in there and did the best he could with them, put it together for me. The Tiger Rose, he decided that he would like to be in there on the laying down of the tracks. I'm afraid that the tracks sound more like Garcia music than mine, which may be good or bad depending on where you're coming from. It has that kind of mellowed out sound that he's into, whereas Runrunners is real, rough and ready, which is more my style.
What about some music to pull off it? What do you go to? What tunes would you play first?
I would Cruel White Water is probably the best tune on that from the point of view of a good vocal delivery. And that Wild Bill is an excellent tune. I really like that tune. I up my sets with it a lot. My excuse for the vocals on this thing, I always have to excuse them. So my kid was being born over in England, and I got my vocals down as quick as I could over the tracks and split, and I had to. I really wish I'd had more time to get that one together vocally. Next time I do a record, I'm going to get it together, because I've learned how to sing in the meantime.
Why is Mickey Hart billed as anti-producer?
Oh, Mickey Hart is the most wired cat you've ever met in your life. He has so many ideas, and we had to, put him in a bag and tie it up with a rope and put him in the corner, and he's beating against it with ideas, and, and we were trying to say, look, even I was at the point, okay, Garcia, you're the producer, and I would argue about it and everything like that, and he'd mutter about it, they always, like that, and they don't understand my true genius, and so finally I sat back, and, we came to the agreement, okay, you can produce this one. I'll see what you can do with my work. But Mickey just is unsuppressible that way. And so it was like we had, and usually having good ideas, like a producer, it has to, like one man has to pretty much decide. And he has to decide what other people want and like that. And so it got to the point where I just finally sat over in the corner myself, like that. I don't have the energy either those cats have in a certain way in the studio, to fight for a production idea. So I just finally sat back and let Mickey and Bob Matthews and Garcia slug it out over what the production was that was going to be. And I could not get a word in edgewise. I just couldn't. I mean, those guys are champion rappers, all three of them. And I'm being a double cancer, I finally have a tendency to go off in the corner and introvert. I just come out when it's time to do my vocals.
And tonight we're talking with Robert Hunter in the third part of a three-part conversation with him. We get up to 1977, and the Grateful Dead release Terrapin Station. What was that album like writing for... certainly, in some respects, a different kind of Grateful Dead. The first one produced outside of the family, essentially. Keith Olsen, who had worked with Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah, I'm of two minds about the production on that. The production is not to my taste. It can now be said, now that we're not pumping it with everything and trying to sell it anymore. It's died the death of records, which is a couple months. Moving up there and then they disappear. Terrapin Station itself is a closest thing to a monumental work I've done. It's like a long song cycle which should take a full album. And what you have of it lyrically is only the introduction. and the story and the resolution of the symbols is all left off. So I don't really know what to say except that Terrapin Station itself, that piece is dreadfully incomplete to my mind. It doesn't appear to come from anywhere or go anywhere, although in fact it does in a complete version of it. There wasn't time to work it all out. They were working under a tight schedule. And I think it was a marvelous concept, and in places it comes off quite well. And other places are just, it sounds like somebody else's record, some other band to me, in a lot of respects. They do a bang-up job of that on stage. I would prefer to hear a live recording of it to the recorded version.
Do you look back very much, or is it really essentially looking forward?
Well, this is my foundation. I was always conscious of laying a really as solid a foundation as I could, and had hopes and fantasies of going off and doing my own number and continuing working with the Dead, which I am. It says in the paper, has me listed as a former lyricist for the Grateful Dead, which I would like to clear up as I still am doing it. Mickey came over with a tape the other day. He said Phil and he had been burning the Midnight Oil. It's time to start writing the next album. And Jerry's got a bunch of lyrics that he's getting together of mine I think I'd probably be time to get hot on that in another couple of weeks. Get the next album out.
What's it like working for, with, and as a member of the Grateful Dead? Has it really been a long, strange trip?
Oh, you better believe it. It's now no longer what does it feel like. It's like, what does it feel like to be a human being or to have a nose? I've been doing it so long, I can't picture myself any other way. It's been, I've been hanging around with these people, I ran into Jerry, I was 19, and he was 18. I'm 36 now, that's half a lifetime ago. That's all I've done in my adult life.
Quite a musical contribution. And I thank you and appreciate the fact that you brought so much fun music to all of us. And I wish you the best of luck. And, you know, look forward to your work in the future, because you've certainly given us something to look forward for. And I want to thank you. Robert Hunter has been our guest. Thank you very much for spending this time with us. That concludes an expanded edition of Sunday at 9 and a conversation with lyricist Robert Hunter. We certainly hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Dennis McNamara, and Sunday at 9 is a weekly presentation here at the radio produced by Michael Ross. Join us again next Sunday night at 9. WLIR Garden City is the radio station.